This is Raised on Little Light, written by Novels in Our Heads and read by Flower Parish. This is a Hatchetfield Universe fic, rated for teen and up audiences, featuring the warning for major character death. Abridged summary: Emma Perkins, An Apocalypse, and How to Step Out of a Shadow.
Breathing in, breathing out, how you been? You settled down, you feeling right, you feeling proud. How are your kids, where are they now? You build a boat, you build a life. You lose your friends, you lose your wife. You settle in to routine, where are you? Does it mean?
1. If there's only one thing you've always been good at, it's running. A bolter, they called you as a kid. Jane with fondness and your mother with derision. Your father didn't call you anything. That would require paying attention. It's second nature. Avoid, deflect, keep your eye on the nearest exit. Once Jane left you with your parents and their unscalable expectations, you started sprinting and never looked back, no matter what you missed in the rear view. It isn't until all of them die that you finally stop. No choice, really, when spite rots its way to grief. Two. Extra, extra, read all about it. Emma Perkins, age 33, female, total burnout and worst sister slash aunt of the year, to return to the town that nearly killed her. That's all to say that the flight back to Hatchetfield is one of the worst moments of your life, if you allow yourself to be dramatic. The turbulence matches the absolute storm of confusion brewing in your brain. You've missed so much, but you'd never forgive yourself for missing this. You've spent so long refusing to feel regretful for the choices you've made. Now, it crashes like a wave, all at once. Three. You don't initially plan to stay. That happens after Tom snaps at you at the funeral, heated whispers coated in anger and bitterness and grief on all sides. He's right, of course. You should have been there, and you weren't. You should have made more of an effort, and you didn't. Now you have to pay the price and try to rebuild a life you never really wanted. So, despite all your best instincts, you stay. You get a shitty job, and then a worse one. You enroll in community college with no fucking clue what you're doing, and you try. Four. However you once felt about your shittiest jobs back in Guatemala, Beanie's is worse. The combination of constantly serving people you haven't seen since high school, your infuriating coworkers, and the fucking singing, it's thoroughly miserable. But it's a job, and you'll take it. School goes remarkably better. Despite your lack of direction going in, botany finds and grabs you by your lapels into a decent GPA, and you find yourself enjoying school for possibly the first time in your entire life. You're even a teacher's pet, even if it's the unhinged biologist. So, of course, it goes to shit.
Five.
5. It starts like this. A customer catches your eye for all his nondescript, well, everything. He tips well, and he's kind, and even though you can tell he's pining, you can't seem to mind. It's a shitty fucking day. Tom's being an ass about letting you see Tim, Nora won't get off your back, and Zoe is next to fucking useless. Barry Swift deciding to be a creep doesn't help either, and when cute bland guy tips, you're about to lose it. And then suddenly, cute bland guy has a name, and you have $5 extra in your pocket. Paul. Six. Paul looks less appealing when he grabs you by the shoulders the next day and begs you to think about the implications. You shove him off, already worn thin from your boss's song and dance routine this morning, literally. You don't think about the implications, not until it's already too late and everything in the store but the both of you is sickly blue. As you're lost in the alleyways, you can't help but wonder about Tim and Tom, whether they're okay, or whether you've lost the last of your family for good, if the gossamer thin thread has finally snapped. Seven. You don't trust any of Paul's colleagues as far as you can throw them, but you do find yourself trusting him, despite everything hardwired in you not to. It's that wisp of hope that has you willing to bring them to Hidgens' place. The professor is exactly how he always is, several planes away from where you find yourself standing. When he mentions his prediction, you're wary, but you want to trust, even if you can't quite get yourself to. After all, he's the one person you actually know here. Just wanting isn't enough, though. It never has been. Eight. Either it's the looming of your imminent death, or you actually do like Paul, because your whispered divulgences are thoroughly out of character. You've spent so much of your life compared to Jane, by you and by everyone else. It's easier, now, to speak about this with someone who never met her, but God, you wish he could have. Charlotte dies. Paul leaves. You want to follow, to help find Bill's daughter, but the professor needs you in the lab, so you stay. You wish you didn't. It's a fool's errand, and your payment is a needle in the neck. Nine. When you awake to Hidgens performing his villainous monologue with all the heart of a Broadway actor, you wish to all hell and back you still had his gun. The rest is kind of a blur. The next thing you know, Paul has rescued you and Ted has abandoned you both. You want to take a second to mourn Hidgens, in all of his melodramatic fashion, but there's no time, not while you're trying to run as far away from his entrails flying as possible. The streets are painted blue. You get the sense that if you look too close, everything will be blue. Ten. And so you run for what will hopefully be the last time. You don't feel any guilt this time. Regret, yes. Grief, yes. But guilt? You're not going to die in Hatchetfield, even if it's the last fucking thing you ever do. You don't expect Zoe. You don't expect the white-hot pain that sears through your left thigh, either, or the blood that sputters down your lips. It's still red, at least. Small blessing, you suppose. The last thing you think of as unconsciousness claims you is Paul. Hope in your heart, possibilities on your tongue. Eleven. You fade in and out for the better part of a week. By the time you are coherent enough to know where you are, your life has changed forever. It already had. You're the only survivor, as far as you know. You have a leg that'll never heal and not much hope. But you are Emma Perkins, made of steel and grit, if not much else, and there's nothing to do but move on. Not that you get a chance. You, Emma Perkins, are strong, but not strong enough to fight this. Next thing you know, all that's left is blue. 12. And you die, and you die, and you die. And it doesn't end. A nuke wipes you off the face of the earth, stabbed to death by the husband of your doppelganger, almost shot by nighthawks, the town brought to its knees by Grace fucking Chastity. You don't remember any of it. You never do. But the song still plays on loop, repeat and remix into a new fucking disaster time and time again. But there's you, and there's Paul. There's your nephew, a brother-in-law you learn to love. Infinite trials and infinite chances. Chances you'll gladly take. The end.
Little light.